in partnership with Kura Wealth, your digital KiwiSaver provider, the NZ Everyday Investor is proud to present News of the Money World, a short show about what's happening in the finance world and how that affects you, the everyday Kiwi. Rupert Carlion and me, Darcy Ungaro, dissect, discuss, and deliberate the latest in money news from around the world. If you'd like to listen into these sessions live, make sure you follow the NZ Everyday Investor on Clubhouse and tune in every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. Let's make a start now. Now, this is the topic, and this is thank you to one of our listeners who commented on one of your posts, I think on LinkedIn, around a post that you did around the world's bubbliest housing markets / 2008 style warnings. This is a Bloomberg article, and it states that New Zealand, Canada, and Sweden rank as the world's frothiest housing markets. So we'll have a chat around what that means, why that is, what are the solutions, and what should first home or next home buyers do. Where should we start? Have you ever been to Sweden?
I have actually, but I've never thought about housing when I was there. It's all apartments, so very different to us here. But never would have thought the frothiest housing market would have existed, because it's such a egalitarian and socialist kind of style country.
Interesting. Well, I have a theory, of course, and it's got everything to do with the communists are coming, as it has to, really.
And of course.
My suspicion is that the more you regulate something, the more distortions there are and the more fixes you have to put into the system to offset the mess that you create with your regulation. And I know this is a little bit of a rant, right? But I think with LVR regulations, with already the bank lending rules that are quite restrictive, that creates a lot of distortions. And with artificially low interest rates, they've got to introduce new regulations to offset those impacts. And here we are. Interest rates are going to be low for a bit longer, but we've got to layer on other regulations and taxes now to offset the negative effects.
Oh, it is what it is. And I agree with you. The extra regulation, and you think about the levels and quality of regulation that's been coming through over the last 2 years, because you forget about the stuff that's happened to landlords, the tax changes. There have been so many different changes that have happened. And at the same time, you have a market which is definitely is massively short on supply. So it's definitely those that have the houses, kind of the ones pulling all the cards, which means you see rents going up, supported a lot, I hate to say it, by government subsidies at the bottom end of town, pushing up house prices, and that combined with low interest rates, and kaboom, you've got explosion in prices.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you think about New Zealand being 14.5% growth in the last year on house prices, when with the same interest rate environment, and we were by far and away the highest of all of the growth. So I think from my perspective where I sit, it is a global problem, but it does seem to be worse here than in a number of the other markets. The stat that I kind of come back to quite a lot is the price to rent ratios and the price to income ratios, where again New Zealand's sitting worse than any other country in the world. And so it's kind of, it is a global problem, but it does seem to be a world that doesn't make any sense. And so I look at all those stats, and then I kind of think anecdotally. I think about back when I graduated, you'd join an accounting firm or a law firm or a bank or whatever, you might have earned $45,000, $40,000 as a graduate. You basically worked pretty hard, and you could, in Auckland, you could save up and buy a house for $400,000 or $500,000. Today, that same person, and so you could, in that world, you needed a deposit of $80,000. That same person today is graduating, earning maybe 45, maximum of 50, so not a huge amount of wage inflation. Except now, the cheapest house they can buy is over $1 million. And so that same person, we're expecting to come up with a $200,000 deposit. And so to me, that's just a set of maths, and that's a set of change which doesn't make any sense. And fundamentally, we seem to be pricing a huge percent of the market right out of it. And I'm not convinced that in other parts of the world, this is what's happening. New Zealand seems to be the worst part for this side. And again, the second anecdote, which I'll leave you with, because everything I basically run my life and all my assumptions based on the people that I speak to. But speaking to a consultant that I did some work with last year out of the US, he lives in Cincinnati. He came over here to New Zealand and he said he just couldn't get his head around it. He lives in Cincinnati, a nice town in the US. He had his 5-bedroom house with a pool and it was worth $700,000. And so he sits there and says, so for me to come up, move over here and have a small villa in town and pay $2 million, there's just a whole world that doesn't work here, right? Hmm. And do you kind of, I go, yeah, okay, well, we're comparing Auckland to Cincinnati. Does that mean Auckland is the next New York or the next Sydney? Maybe. Auckland's a pretty good place. But then when I go places like Hook Bay, Masterton, all of the provincial areas and outside of Auckland where the salaries aren't there, we're seeing exactly the same stuff. You are seeing house prices kind of, which have almost, I mean, Gisborne, they doubled last year. I mean, so that's why I kind of go like it just, it all feels a bit nuts.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And perhaps maybe it'll take a while for us to actually see the root cause of this phenomenon. And you might be able to kind of figure out what some of the causes are in New Zealand specifically as to why it's so out of whack. But I agree, it's a little bit out of whack. I'd like to think though that, hey, Cincinnati is cool, but hey, you know, anywhere in Auckland or anywhere in Hawke's Bay or anywhere in Christchurch, I'd much rather be. But you know, how much of a premium do you put on that, right? That's probably the thing. The one thing I was going to say, Rupert, though, like I've heard of this a few times, and I know a lot of people kind of lean on this, and you mentioned it as well, the price-to-income ratio. Presumably, that means the house price to the income, you know, the average income to the average house price ratio. And I think it's an interesting metric because it touches on a point that I think we often kind of gloss over. When we talk about affordability and when we talk about how it's so unaffordable now than what it used to be, you kind of need to unpackage that a little bit because there's two forms of unaffordability. There's the actual cost of the house itself, you know, the actual purchase price of that house or value. And then there's the cost of owning it, which is completely different if you're a borrower. So if you're a borrower and you are borrowing $1 million, that $1 million would have cost $32,000 a year in interest last year, 12 months ago. This year, it's $22,000. So it's $10,000 cheaper to own that property per year this year compared to last year. With that $10,000 savings, you could borrow an additional $450,000. So a $1 million property last year should actually be worth $1.45 million today. It's actually cheaper now to own a home than it was this time last year from an affordability or servicing point of view.
Yes, as long as you go with the expectation that you don't need to pay that back, right?
Oh, yeah. Don't worry about paying back the mortgage.
No, because your 400 grand over the 30-year life of a mortgage is just put an extra $12,000 a year in terms of servicing cost.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of flaws in this, right? Because it makes you more sensitive to interest rate movements as well. And it ignores the fact that it is actually more expensive because that deposit that you have to save is now $50,000 more this time compared to last year.
But I think you've hit the nail on the head in that you're right, the income affordability issues. Interest rates have dealt with a lot of those because, I don't know, in my personal situation, I agree, I focus on my interest bill. I don't focus on the repayments. I don't focus on anything else. And I think that's where most people are at. It's you focus on that side. But to me, that is an issue. And that as a country and as a generation, we focus on the interest bill. We don't focus on the repayments and paying that mortgage down. And actually, once we've got the equity in our house, we just keep on using it and we keep on spending it, keep on going.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why Giltraps, Land Rover, and all of these car yards are completely sold out right now. A decent chunk of it is because people have just been drawing down on their mortgages to buy a flash new car.
Yeah.
Because they've got a massive chunk of equity, which is what house price rises have done for them.
That's right. They're feeling the wealth effect. Yeah, I guess what I was trying to say is that it is actually more affordable to sustain ownership because of the lower cost of interest. But from the point of view of getting into the market, which I think is probably the most important problem to solve, especially for first home buyers. The reason why first home buyers can't get into the market is it's got nothing to do with how cheap the money is. It's got everything to do with what the rules are. And to reintroduce loan to valuation ratios in this, you know, back to where you have to have 20% to buy your first home, if you really want to make it easier, you want to dial that down so that they can actually afford to buy a home with 5 or 10% deposit. Even if that means you have to increase the threshold for property investors further, like that seems to be the most common sense thing to do, because it is, you have to save basically $50,000 more this year compared to last year just to get your 20% deposit if you're working on $1 million average price this year.
And look, I think that's a really good point. I think, but I think there's a bit of confusion, right, on those 20% rules, because I agree with you. If we wanted to make access to housing and housing ownership a universal goal, allowing people their first home, or even second home or whatever, having a higher equity, a lower equity ratio, sorry, would be really beneficial. But what we also need to remember is one of the core reasons why those LVR restrictions were brought in was because the Reserve Bank was very nervous on housing. Mm. And therefore, they wanted to make sure that the banks had some buffer, because fundamentally, the driver behind the global financial crisis back in 2008 was an over-levered banking system that were pretty happy lending on houses up to 90-95%. And that caused a whole series of other issues. So I think what I agree with you, we need to figure out ways to make it easier for people to enter the housing market. But we need to remember that 20% ratio, we need to be really clear. Are we doing that as a way to suppress the housing market, or are we doing that as a way to de-risk our banks? And let's be really clear on the reason. Mm. And if it's to depress the housing market, well, it hasn't really worked, so let's give up on it. Hmm. And I agree with you, just creates a whole series of other issues. But if it's a way to de-risk our banks, which I think we should be doing, then actually it's not something that's overly bad either.
Hmm. Do you think we have de-risked our banks, though, in the last few years? Do you think they're in a bit of a stronger position? They're profitable. They're still here.
Oh, look, the banks definitely are stronger than they have been for a very, very long time. They've got higher equity ratios. They are all profitable. If we did see a 20-25% drop in house prices, we are going to see some real issues in the banking sector.
Right.
Fundamentally, these companies, yeah, they're safe, they're solid, but they are not all that. They've still got 3-4%. Equity ratios, right? So actually it doesn't take much to go wrong in a bank for a whole lot to go wrong. And given that housing is their largest asset class, I think you would be really nervous sitting there kind of watching that kind of unfold. And then if you're the Reserve Bank, the banking system might not go under, but fundamentally it's going to take a long time for the banks to recover from that, which means they're going to be holding back lots of capital. Takes a long time for the banks to kind of build up the strength to start lending again, and you potentially go into a European scenario of a lost decade.
And that's the important thing to remember. That's a really good point, right? Because if there is pressure, they're going to hoard capital and they're going to try and make themselves safer, but that means that they're sucking money out of the economy, which means that everybody kind of goes down with them, right?
And I mean, even our Prime Minister recently said, I mean, and this is the honest truth of it. She said, look, we're trying to tame house price growth. When I think one of the questions was asked, well, do you want to see prices go negative and come back down? And even she said, look, there's only one thing worse than rampant house price inflation, and that's house price deflation. Mm-hmm. And so I think, because of the damage that it does to our banking and financial system and the general economy, it's kind of one of those where we're all in this game of saying, hey, what's done is done. We need to kind of try our best to make sure it doesn't fall any further or keep on accelerating as fast as it can. But we're all petrified of the fact of what happens if there is a decline. So you talk a lot to first home buyers and a lot to people that are getting into the property market. What's the advice what do you think is relevant here? Because I've gone from 12, or my view on any big investment decision has always been, hey, just don't do anything unless you feel rushed. If you feel rushed, if you're not confident, if you're not happy with what you're doing, take your time, figure out something that works for you. Whereas in the last kind of 6-12 months, so you say that, and then 2 months later, the same house is worth 15% more. What's the perspective, and what are you thinking about for first home buyers or people getting into the market at the moment that are feeling stressed, pressured, and going, I just need to buy something so I don't miss out on the next 30% of capital gains?
It's like anything, isn't it? It's you have to do it when it's right for you, and you have to do it as soon as you're able to for the right reasons. Like, I think a lot of people go into this thinking that it's just an investment. And, you know, sure, there's an investment flavor to it, but it's also your home. And there's a lot of non-financial reasons why you want to own your own home. And there's a lot of good reasons why you should pursue doing it outside of growing wealth. It's been politicized, it's been economized, it's been bastardized, but really it's just a freaking home to keep you dry. And we all should be able to pursue that goal. I think just setting a course to being able to buy a home at some stage is good in and of itself. So if someone said to me, hey, you know, should I even bother trying to save for a first home and get into my first home? It looks so far away, and now it's even way further away. What's the best thing I should be doing? Save for your first home. That's the best advice. Yeah. Even if it's not going to happen, even if you think it's not going to happen, I should say, because the behavior and the patterns and the discipline that get created when you face towards that goal is a good thing. It means that you're going to be budgeting. It means that you're going to be not spending money on dumb stuff. It means that you're going to have a goal. So if that feels like it's too far away, it's just because we can't see the future. But fortunately, we were able to buy a home with 5% deposit when we bought our first home. And it wasn't so popularized and politicized back then. And it was just something that some people did. I don't know. It's almost being teased in front of us as something that we should pursue way more than, you know, for our own reasons.
I actually think that's a really good point. Because I remember when I first started working, none of us, maybe it's the cohort of people that I hung out with, but none of us even dreamed or even thought about or talked about houses. It just wasn't even part of our, we were all busy working, playing, and getting ready for our trips OE. But now I notice it's very, you know, I think you're right. Actually, everyone becoming more and more obsessed with this housing thing and so desperate to get on that ladder a whole lot younger. It's now normal for people in their mid-20s who are thinking extremely hard about it. Whereas I know back when I was in my mid-20s, none of us even thought it was an option or something we should think about.
I know. It's good and bad, isn't it?
And fundamentally, even if it's not a home, everyone needs to be saving. You need Absolutely. To be saving for later in life. You need to be saving for things. And fundamentally, having a pot of savings there might just mean that you're ready to jump on a house when something comes available.
Yeah.
Or you might manage to keep it invested and you do well on the investments and that grows a pot and you do things differently. But I 100% agree. It shouldn't be written off. And it's just another form of saving, right? And it needs to be done anyway.
Yeah. And while you're saving, you know, if you think it's going to take 10 years, then that's great. Then you can kind of factor that into how you save. Yeah. But tell me, like, how would you feel? Like, put yourself in the position where you don't own a home and you're in this environment right now and you're looking to get into the housing market. You know that it feels a little bit bubbly. It feels like the game is rigged, right? Because you have to have a huge deposit, which you don't seem to be able to get. What would you do? Like, would you kind of wait for this supposed pinprick to happen in the bubble?
I'd leave Auckland.
You'd leave Auckland?
I'd be really uncertain and unhappy because I think the problem with the tenancy laws in New Zealand is they are far looser than in most other countries and very landlord friendly. So as a tenant, you have very few protections. And so if I had a family like I do and didn't own my own house, I'd be constantly petrified that I was going to get kicked out, and what does that mean for schooling, and what does that mean for all of that kind of stuff, right? So I would be scared. I would be thinking really hard about how can I create a home, how can I create something that is mine, that I know that I can have at least 5 years here with my family and with my kids. And probably, I hate to say it, that means moving out of Auckland and trying to figure out a way to do something in a slightly cheaper environment or a slightly cheaper place. And I know that sounds drastic, but I just think, my kids are at school, and if I sat there and went, oh, well, if my landlord in 6 months' time decides that I can't stay here or something goes wrong with the house, having to move him to a new school because I move into a different zone, or it's just, yeah, it'd be really, really hard. And it would petrify me, and I'm sure it would petrify my wife. So I think this is a really quick way of saying, or sorry, a really long way of saying I'd figure out a way so I can be in a place where I do own my own roots and do have certainty.
Yeah.
Where you started off is right. It is so unfair what's happening in the housing market, because for so many people, they thought they were sorted, they thought they were on track, and then the goalposts have just been moved. And that's a little bit, so it's kind of, I don't know, this conversation's made me think, is it a little bit like crypto, where there's a whole lot of people jumping in at the moment as quick as they can, just because they don't want to miss out? And is that a little bit of that bubbly kind of frothing going on here, where people are just moving as quick as they can, buying stuff unseen, doing whatever they can just to make sure they don't miss out because they're scared that their plans are going to be derailed? And when I think about what I've just said about what I would do, I 100% get it. And I, as much as I like to think of myself as a very financially rational person, I would probably do the same thing. But that's a definition of a bubble.
And that's why it's quite relevant that we're having this discussion, right? Because if we're reading articles like this saying that our housing market is in the bubbly territory, then, and it's not to say that it's going to crash imminently, by the way, but it could be bubbly for quite some time. I think maybe we need to
allocated housing, Darcy. You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Oh man, I'm getting sick here. awesome. Well, let's leave it there for
okay,
now,
thanks, Darcy.
And we'll do this again in a couple of weeks' time.